Lots of sirens around here.
This is New York. I mean, the sirens and this, we just work around it. We adapt.
I think my hustle was being as lazy as possible, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. You're speaking to a very similar human being.
My teachers, to figure out exactly where that line was between like getting away with stuff and actually having to do homework. I went to school for engineering, for like math and science, not for business. No interest in business school. Wanted to do international development. Went into the Peace Corps after I graduated from college. I realized I was much more creative than I thought I was.
Yeah.
Having to speak French in West Africa for 3 years.
Mais oui.
I was personally frustrated by a lot of things that I saw. I think I'm much more excited about the ability of the private economy and private companies to impact people's lives. As a 22-year-old arriving in West Africa, I was naive and thought that I could change the world. Just give me a few years. I was actually a teacher for the first 2 years that I was there. Government funding had nothing to do with nonprofits. And again, I think those things have a place. More focused around did we spend the money, and less focused on did we get an impact for the money we spent. It's a bigger opportunity for me personally to actually be working in the private economy. I came home, came back to the US, so I actually became a bartender.
I love it.
Sharpening your interpersonal skills, sharpening your memory, and I ended up finding something in New York City. So for me, definitely has always been like pushing myself to make the next move, not remaining complacent in the place that I am. And so, I mean, it was a big psychological jump to say, I can go live in New York City. Digital magazine that was based here that was willing to take me on as an intern. It's called The Green Economy. In 3 weeks of interning there, I was asked to be the CEO.
Okay, now that's, huh?
Yeah, first of all, unpaid. There was an equity vesting situation. But this was also a huge learning experience for me. And so I spent the next year going out to as many meetups as I possibly could. So part of my job as CEO was figure out how to take all this content that's been created and monetize it. Yeah. And so we did that somewhat effectively, but I ended up getting an offer from another startup to go for a paid position there.
Sure.
So it was a social media management software, 2012. And unfortunately, we just didn't find the right business model. I had an idea for a company. I don't know if it's fair to call it a startup, that I was getting passionate and excited about. Pretty much maxed out on my credit cards at this point. So it's called Strategy Hack. I ended up working on it for 2.5 years. And it hosted one-day events, matching young, product-oriented startups with professional marketers. So for a day, they get to work for a startup. They get to think and act and feel like someone who has zero constraints. We had a decent amount of revenue, but we could never quite figure out the right business model. And so I just like, I went on an all hot dog diet for a little while.
No vegetables?
No, I got a big ass sinus infection after
your entire hot dog diet.
Yes.
I love it.
I do not recommend the hot dog only diet.
Hot dogs plus maybe some sauerkraut could work.
Could work. That's your vegetable. Absolutely. I mean, it was my first exposure to enterprise sales.
Yeah.
Trying to sell something to a company. One of the co-founders of Startup Weekend.
Okay.
At a networking event. Ended up deciding to start a company together.
So what was this company? I'm on the tip of my toes. So
that was 4 years ago. That's the same company that I'm running now. It's called ReCorp. We are effectively trying to displace management consulting. Grandiose statement, but what it means in reality is that all of our consultants are ex-entrepreneurs, people who've built and sold companies in the past, who are actively coming into large corporations, large projects inside corporations, and bringing their startup expertise into that situation. Mm-hmm. Over the last 4 years, we've worked with tons of major brands in some pretty high-level engagements, new product development projects, some of which have turned into actual products. Voyager was one of our consulting projects. Someone, a funder who is very excited about the idea of starting an incubator for travel companies. We spent 4 months putting the whole thing together, recruiting the team, including John Mattson, who's done an amazing job in the last 3 years of turning that vision into a very robust reality. So Startup Grind is an event series that is organized around a fireside chat idea. So it's an interviewer and an interviewee, and the interviewee is meant to always be someone who's very successful in the startup realm. I've been running the New York City chapter for the last 7 years. Startup Grind had about 30 chapters, 30, and it now has about 800 chapters around the world. Where you live or you're traveling, you can almost always find a Startup Grind chapter.
What is startup thinking?
Rapid testing and iteration.
Can we talk crypto for two blocks?
You know, trends are self-fulfilling.
So, Peter,
yes,
how do you think you have grown as an entrepreneur? In what way?
Learn and feel that values and personal motivation are really at the core of entrepreneurship and trying to launch something new, at least for me. Also, it's also a guiding principle for what we do with ReCorp now, in saying it can be better, it should be better. We have people to make it better.
Hello, startup hunters. Thank you guys so much for listening. This podcast would be nothing without you. And also, this podcast is a startup, so I need all the help that I can get. Would you please leave me a good review in the App Store? This would be huge. That's it. On to the episode.
Welcome to Startup Hunter, also streaming on YouTube. I am here with Peter Crisdale, who is an entrepreneur of many sorts. And right now you can think of Peter as disrupting management consulting. And before we really get into your day-to-day, Peter, we go all the way back on this show. So I would like to know where you were born and what did your parents do?
So I was born in Toronto, Canada. My mom has a doctorate in theology and has been teaching at various universities over the last 3 decades. I was actually born while she was getting her PhD. My dad is a residential architect.
Yeah. Now, does he have his own practice?
Yeah, so, most of his life.
So there, right there is what I'm looking for, which is maybe a kernel of entrepreneur. You've been surrounded by entrepreneurship for your whole life. Do you feel like any of his and maybe your mom's entrepreneurial tendencies rubbed off on you in some way?
Sure, yeah. As it relates to my mom, I think that's a little less clear. But for my dad, absolutely. You know, he's been running a business his whole life, and he worked out of our house for a long time. And so absolutely, it has a big role to play. I think they were both big role models for me. Interestingly, I think as a professor, you're also a kind of academic entrepreneur in the sense that you have to write your own papers. You have to continue to prove yourself within the academic environment. And so there's a degree of entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial skill required to be a successful academician too.
Yeah. So we've got the foundation set. Peter, I would like to know, can you remember the first hustle you ever had? The younger, the better. If you're in diapers, you know, you win.
I was definitely hustling my sister for a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
And was she older?
Younger.
And what kind of things were involved in this?
Well, so I grew up in a Christian household. And so as kids, we were always asked to give up something for Lent. And it had to be something that, you know, you actually use and something that you would miss while you're not using it. So I decided to give up video games.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I convinced my sister to play the video games for me. And I would tell her exactly what to do. Like, go over there, jump, press this button. And so I like found this workaround. Lots of sirens around here.
This is New York. I mean, the sirens and this, we just work around it. We adapt.
I like it.
And so I basically like found this workaround of still technically being on Lent and not playing video games while just telling my sister exactly what to do.
So she played the games for you?
And I told her exactly what moves to make.
You were like the video game director.
Yeah, so to speak. Oh. Or she was my proxy.
Wow, that's incredible. I love it.
That was my first hustle.
Yeah. So you found a collaborator and
that's right.
In your sister. And moving forward a little bit older, can you remember any hustles that you did outside of the house?
It's a good question. I think, unlike a lot of other entrepreneurial people, I think my hustle was being as lazy as possible, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. You're speaking to a very similar human being.
I would figure out the least amount of effort required to do anything.
Yes.
It's not like I wasn't like making and selling video games on CDs or like doing some of the like classical things you might think of an entrepreneurial skill set, but I was definitely like assessing every single one of my teachers and every project that we had to do and figuring out like, do I really have to meet that deadline? Can I? And I mean, it's a skill that's become very useful in the rest of my life. I think more than anything in high school, I learned to like psychologically assess my teachers to figure out exactly where that line was between like getting away with stuff and actually having to do homework.
Yeah. Most entrepreneurs drop out of school. It feels to me like maybe you didn't, but you still found your own way.
I was very good at school because I figured out how to game the system.
Yeah.
So I was very, very good at taking standardized tests. The multiple choice, like Scantron, bubble in tests.
Uh-huh. Well, you could sort of, they sort of get, have information in the multiple.
In the test.
That you can use to deduce, like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's one example of kind of teacher manipulation, and I'm not gonna mention the teacher's name on purpose, but it's an English teacher, and we were supposed to write a weekly essay for like an entire semester. And we had to turn it in every Friday. And I very quickly realized that I didn't actually have to turn in the essay. I could tell him like, well, I wrote it, but I left it at home. Or, I just didn't have time this week. I had this big project, I had a big test. And I figured out very quickly that I could get away with that. And so by the end of the semester, I owed him like 8 essays.
Yeah.
And I literally just like, in a matter of like 3 hours, just like quickly wrote off 8 essays because he said, you have to give them to me or you're not gonna graduate.
Indeed.
This is my senior year.
Indeed.
And so I'd scribbled them out and I'd handed him 8 pieces of paper and I got an A.
Do you think you developed any self-awareness of this sort of tendency of yours at that point?
Not at that point, no. Definitely like, later. So I also have an interesting or different background from a lot of people because I did not think that I would be an entrepreneur. I didn't have, I went to school for engineering, for like math and science, not for business. No interest in business school. I wanted to do international development. So I went into the Peace Corps after I graduated from college. I was in the Peace Corps for 3 years in West Africa.
Now, all over West Africa?
No, in a country called Burkina Faso. I usually say West Africa because no one's heard of Burkina Faso.
Well, a few people have.
A few people have.
Does there a coast on Burkina Faso, or is it landlocked?
It is landlocked. Yeah. There's no coast. It is desertified, so it's in an area called the Sahel, which is just below the Sahara Desert.
Now, here's what I want to know. What was the impetus to say, was it just like you woke up one morning and said, hey, I'm going into the Peace Corps, I'm going to West Africa? Was that chosen for you?
Not at all. I would say it was very deviant from the easy thing to do, which would have been to go work for some major engineering firm. Which I actually did a internship program living here in New York City for a semester in 2004.
And what school did you go to?
I went to Cornell.
Yeah.
Cornell University.
Which is in upstate New York, Ithaca.
Yep.
Don't they have their own currency?
They did, yes.
What was it called again?
I don't know what it was called. I found out about this recently.
Ah.
I only found out about this because of some like blockchain article in the last year or so. But.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe the city of Ithaca issued its own currency back before there was a standardized United States currency.
So you're studying engineering in college. You do your internship here in New York.
And I hated it. I was sitting in a cubicle in an office on 34th Street. We were literally like
two blocks away
from where I did my internship. I got very good at Minesweeper.
Yeah.
I had like five different bosses and nothing to do. And unlike that was actually a big point in my life where I started to transition from what can I get away with to now I'm just bored. I'm actively looking for work to do.
Yeah.
And so I was going around to these five different bosses that I had, saying like, please give me something to do. Like, you know, the first few weeks of getting paid to do nothing were great. And then it was just like, I'm here for six more months. Like, I need something.
Sure.
I don't want to just like ride the subway for an hour each way every day to sit and do nothing. And so I kind of, I guess somewhat entrepreneurially, started to find different projects to work on. Uh-huh. I actually worked on, very few people will remember this, but New York City had a bid to host the 2012 Olympics.
Uh-huh.
And so I ended up working on that because the firm that it was a large engineering firm. And it turned out like I found a person who actually said like, yeah, I could use help.
Now,
it turned out he was putting that bid together.
2012, so but date me, like what year was it?
That was in 2004.
Okay, so you're at summer internship. This was senior year of college?
Not even. I think it was junior year of college.
Right.
Yeah.
Super interesting. Go on.
I mean, that was about it. I ended up doing a lot of projects that were really boring. I did one redesigning a salt shed for one of the bridges. There's like a salt storage facility next to one of the bridges in Manhattan.
Like what intern, you know, did you study mechanical engineering?
I studied civil and environmental engineering.
Okay, so that's
pretty close to mechanical.
Yeah, so I could see the salt shed thing happening. Here I was thinking you studied computer engineering. That would be a little more of a stretch.
Yeah. I tend to say engineering instead of being more specific because it's so much less relevant what type of engineering that I studied when it was almost 15 years ago. The biggest things that I got out of engineering are highly, highly relevant to entrepreneurship and tech startups because they are all related to project planning, understanding resources and how to manage the flow of resources. And like, those are a lot of hidden skills when you're thinking about, say, like building a skyscraper or building a bridge or building some kind of environmental resource system.
So it sounds like the salt shed project was not too fun, but the Olympics project, was that more fun?
It was more interesting. It was much more creative. And one of the things that I realized is there was really no space in that work environment for creativity of any kind. I mean, literally, the people who got any kind of creative input or say were people who'd been working at the firm for more than 20 years.
Right.
And more so, most of all the creative work that had to be done was being done mostly by architects and not by engineers.
So you quickly realized
I realized I was much more creative than I thought I was.
Yeah. And so I'm still trying to figure out, how did this lead to Peace Corps West Africa?
That's a good question. So for me, one of the reasons that I chose civil and environmental engineering is because even leaving high school, I already knew that I wanted to pursue some kind of international development.
Mm.
And so I knew that I was really good at math and science, so engineering was a go. I didn't need to learn a language in order to do engineering, which backfired because I ended up having to speak French in West Africa for 3 years.
May we?
So I thought that those would be the most useful and relevant skills to the thing that I thought I wanted to do when I was in high school. But fast forward to actually being in the Peace Corps, there are a lot of things that I realized are very frustrating and inefficient you know, coming from an engineering background to then doing international development, I was personally frustrated by a lot of things that I saw, whether it was graft or just inefficient project management. And I really, over the course of 3 years, decided, I think I'm much more excited about the ability of the private economy and private companies to impact people's lives than the ability of government money and nonprofits to impact people's lives.
So you felt...
It's not a blanket statement, but it's definitely true for me.
You felt, even in the Peace Corps, that you weren't totally free to be creative? Or just...
I had infinite freedom in the Peace Corps. There's almost zero oversight.
There's bureaucracy to deal with.
There's bureaucracy. Well, so primarily, as a 22-year-old arriving in West Africa, I was naive and thought that I could change the world. Just give me a few years.
Yeah.
And I very quickly realized how entrenched a lot of problems are within a much larger system. So as an example, the country of Burkina Faso has a 75% tariff on electronics.
Okay.
Which means that, let's say that you're a business trying to import laptops to Burkina Faso.
Yeah.
You can buy a laptop wholesale at $200. You have to pay $150 just to get that $200 laptop into the country.
Yes.
Which means that you have to sell it at, let's say, $450 to make a profit. So all of a sudden, a $200 laptop becomes a $450 laptop.
Now there has to be some way to get cheap electronics there.
You could smuggle it, but not on a large scale.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could, if you were willing to risk going to jail for a very, very long time. But yeah, not anything that anyone wants to do pragmatically. And so, but then you think about that and you think about what does it take to provide basic computer skills to the students in the educational system of Burkina Faso, right? And then you think about the food scarcity. Burkina Faso is one of the lowest countries on the UN Human Development Index. So very high food scarcity. Often, like in the hot season, more than 50% food scarcity, meaning people don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And so I learned all these things, but these are not things that you can affect as a 22-year-old Peace Corps volunteer.
Sure.
You know?
By yourself.
By myself.
Did you try to rally some of your fellow core members to, you know, and say, hey, let's fix these problems?
We did do a few things. So there was actually, very much predating me, there was an initiative to have some volunteers be like tech teachers.
Yeah.
And so there were some high schools in much more populated areas of Burkina Faso that did actually have computers. So I was actually a teacher for the first 2 years that I was there. I was a secondary education volunteer. And there were, I think, eight of us, not including me, who were specifically assigned to teach computer skills. Now, this is pre-smartphone. This is pre-data network. And so we're talking about satellite internet, satellite wired internet.
Yes.
But
even back then, Google was talking about, you know, its crazy plans to do balloons.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, to be clear, there were data networks and smartphones in other parts of the world, but definitely not in Burkina Faso.
Yeah. So you get frustrated, ultimately.
Yeah, I want to give one other example, which is that when I arrived in 2007 in Burkina Faso, there were, you could buy a dumb phone, a digital phone for a wireless phone for like $200 US. And just for comparison, the like monthly salary of a middle class maybe lower middle class person in the country of Burkina Faso is $125.
So there's no way that they're probably going
to
be able
to. You have to save up. It's very hard. If you buy one, you're buying it for your whole family and you're sharing it amongst the family.
Yeah.
By the time I left in 2010, 3 years later, $20.
We'll talk about a big shift.
Yeah, and so there were three competing cell phone companies that were all competing against each other for rates. If you are texting someone who has the same plan as you do, then it's a discount and things like that. So there was intense market competition driving down very quickly the cost of this technology, to the point that basically when I arrived, I think there was roughly 10% coverage across the country, both in terms of towers and in terms of cell phone owners. And by the time I left, it was virtually 100%. So it's not to say that every single person had a cell phone, but every single family was very, very likely to have a cell phone. And so when you look at that, you have to think about that effect on agriculture and why would people be so interested in having a smartphone? Because most of the economy, 80% of the economy and 90% of the total population is agriculture, farmers. If you're a farmer and you're trying to become more prosperous, you are selling a part or all of what you're growing for money. And so when you have a cell phone, you can quickly text people. You can find out the market prices at all the different markets close to you.
Sure.
And so just having that cell phone has a huge equilibrating effect on the entire agrarian marketplace and crop prices.
And you get and to put it in simple terms, if you as a farmer get that phone for $20, you're going to get a competitive edge.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so all of that, by the way, is private economy, right? And that was one of the biggest shifts that I observed in those 3 years. Had nothing to do with government funding, had nothing to do with nonprofits. And again, I think those things have a place, but much bigger impact than any of the things that the NGOs were doing. And so that in combination with seeing, in my final year, I worked for a big NGO, and I got to see a lot more up close exactly what was happening. I got to see that, for the most part, the metrics, at least at that time, were much more focused around did we spend the money, and less focused on did we get an impact for the money we spent.
Yeah, because they're trying to meet some quota or some...
Yeah. Absolutely. So USAID wants to be able to say, we spent 0.7% of tax revenue on development projects.
Yep.
Right? And then when you have an agency that's structured that way, then that trickles down into how the projects are actually executed. Long story short, I had this sort of public funding experience on one side, and I had this private funded experience on the other side, and I realized there's a much bigger opportunity for me personally to actually be working in the private economy and shaping and changing people's lives through private enterprise.
Okay, so here you are. You've been working at an NGO. I assume you weren't a vice president. I assume you weren't getting huge bonuses based off of your activities.
Correct.
So here you are, 2010. You have this new sort of direction in your life.
Yep.
You're in Burkina Faso.
Yep.
And what was the first thing you did?
So I came home, came back to the US. I wasn't as clear on like summarizing that experience as I am now. And so I was trying to figure out what the next thing was. I had family spread out in different places. So I went and lived with my mom in Nashville for a little while. I went and lived with my dad in Ontario for a little while. I decided that psychologically, like coming from living in a place that was very relatively remote, I wasn't quite ready to move to New York City or Washington, D.C. or some other big city yet. So I have a lot of family in Pittsburgh, and I moved to Pittsburgh. While I was still trying to figure out what I was going to do, I was trying to, I had, when you leave the Peace Corps, they give you a little bit of money. And so I had a little bit of runway for myself to try to spend time figuring out what the next thing was. And so I actually became a bartender.
I love it. That, I've said this many times on the show. That's the one thing that I wish I had done.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, it's sharpening your interpersonal skills, sharpening your memory, and you know, you're taking a bunch of orders. And it's depending on where you work, I guess it could pay pretty well. It didn't pay very well for me.
But it's flexibility. Like weekend pay tends to be better than weekday pay.
Yeah, now, yeah. So I wasn't the only bartender that worked at this place. And so you have to, I was not getting the best shifts.
Yeah.
And so, but it was fine. It was like bringing me some income while I was trying to figure out the next thing. And I ended up finding something in New York City. So I was like, it had been some months. I was like, I have to make this move. And so I think a big thing for me definitely has always been like pushing myself to make the next move, not remaining complacent in the place that I am. And so, I mean, it was a big psychological jump to say, I can go live in New York City.
Okay.
And there were a lot of other people around me in Pittsburgh who were like, yeah, someday I think I'm going to move to New York City.
But you were like, you know, now's the time.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this window of like, I could, you know, I could keep bartending. I really liked the main bartender at the place that I was working, but
you were comfortable.
Yeah, but I wasn't comfortable in the sense that I knew there was something else. I knew that I wanted to accomplish more.
Yes.
I had left Burkina Faso with this mandate of I want to do like, I think I'd wanted to find my major way to contribute to the world, and it turned out that the Peace Corps and living in Burkina Faso was a way for me to learn and me to gain a lot of skills and understanding of the world, but it wasn't my major contribution to the world.
Sure. So you decide to come to New York to build up the courage, and tell me, did you bartend when you got here, or what? Yeah. How did you make it?
I found a. This is 2011 now. I found a digital magazine that was based here that was willing to take me on as an intern.
What was that called?
It's called The Green Economy. Uh-huh. Still exists. It's like a media outlet for sustainable business and green business practices.
Uh-huh.
Generally trying to take lessons learned from major corporations and apply them to mid and small size companies. The woman who had created this magazine had created a large amount of content. Remember, this is 2011 when, Blogger had been already sold to Google maybe like 6 or 8 years before that.
Oh, yeah.
Twitter was still somewhat nascent, mostly used by media personalities. And we were in an era where we're still trying to figure out how to monetize content on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're looking at like media paywalls, you're looking at advertising. I think a lot of ad networks hadn't yet been really established. And at least for us, finding an ad service that would allow us to monetize our content effectively was not gonna happen. We're too small of a publication to really garner the attention of a lot of the big ad networks or exchanges. In 3 weeks of interning there, I was asked to be the CEO.
Okay, now that's, huh? That's a, tell me more.
Yeah, first of all, unpaid. There was an equity vesting situation.
Okay, a little bit better than unpaid and no equity.
Yeah. But this was also a huge learning experience for me. And so I spent the next year going out to as many meetups as I possibly could. So.
Now, could you afford to live unpaid?
Not for long.
Yeah. So
I ran out of cash after about a year. And at that point, I'd already had the conversation of like, look, I'm getting to the end of my runway here. I'm really gonna need to get paid. And part of my job as CEO was figure out how to take all this content that's been created and monetize it.
Yes.
And so we did that somewhat effectively, but I ended up getting an offer from another startup to go for a paid position there.
Sure, and that's probably not a difficult, I'm sure actually it was difficult because you had invested a lot. I mean, this was your baby, sort of.
Sort of, but I also, it was someone else's baby.
Yeah.
It was definitely someone else's baby. It was not the thing that I had created and been really passionate about.
It was your adopted child for a little bit.
So I wanted to honor that, and they basically had like right of first refusal on me. If they were able to give me $2,000 a month, I would have stayed.
Okay, so pretty clear cut.
Yep.
And
so I spent the next year working at this next startup, which is also a complicated story, and it ended up running out of money.
So give me just a little highlight, like what type of startup?
So it was a social media management software.
And the year precisely?
2012.
Okay, so it's really the height of social media frenzy, even though that's still, definitely, you could argue that's still going on.
Yeah.
But it's the beginning.
It's the heart of social mobile local.
Somolo.
Yeah. It's the heart of platforms like Radiant 6 and Sprout Social being created right at the same time. Ours was not among those names, unfortunately. But the intention was, this is a platform through which individuals and brands can manage all of their social media, schedule stuff in advance, manage all of their interactions with commenters and likers and followers. And unfortunately, we just didn't find the right business model.
No, were you the CEO of that?
No, I was not.
You were, what role did you play?
Title unspecified, yeah. But operations and marketing.
Okay, so just
lead operations and marketing.
Nonetheless, it just wasn't your vision, and all your skin wasn't on the table. You were getting paid, so.
So while working on that, I had an idea for a startup. I had an idea for a company. I don't know if it's fair to call it a startup that I was getting passionate and excited about. Went on Christmas break, end of 2012. Came back January 2nd, 2013. Phone call from the CEO at 10 a.m. It's like Monday, first day back at work. I don't have any money.
That's what he says to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that was kind of like, all right, part ways there.
Yeah.
I was pretty much maxed out on my credit cards at this point.
Yeah.
Didn't really have much money, didn't have any runway left. And so I thought, why not start a company?
Okay. Even when you're
exactly the opposite.
When you're super low, you're like, why don't I take even more risk?
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes there is value in quadrupling and, you know, rolling a 64 on that doubling die.
That's just jumping right off the cliff.
Yeah. So what did this startup do?
So it's called Strategy Hack. I ended up working on it for 2.5 years, and it hosted one day events matching young product oriented startups with professional marketers.
Yes.
And so all the professional marketers were coming from big brands and agencies working on things like Pepsi, Verizon, Coca-Cola, Chase Bank, all these like major consumer brands where they're used to managing millions of dollars of budgets. And they would sit across the table from startups who had like maybe I can give you $5,000 this year for marketing. And so it was a challenge on both sides. It was a challenge to the product-oriented startup who had this great idea and they thought like millions of people are gonna use this, but they didn't actually know how to create a brand, how to communicate with potential customers, and how to quickly and concisely say what it is that my product does.
Yes.
And then simultaneously, you have the marketer who's used to managing these huge budgets, who all of a sudden has to work like a startup. And so for a day, they get to work for a startup. They get to think and act and feel like someone who has zero constraints, right? You could, there was at least one startup in all of these events that we did that actually changed their name during the event. Because they got such strong feedback that the name didn't match what they were doing. And so for the marketer sitting down, you have this absolute freedom that you don't ever have when you're working on a big brand. So that we operated, we had a decent amount of revenue, but we could never quite figure out the right business model to make it a larger scalable company.
And was, even though you didn't, you know, hit the red, were you,
or the black rather.
Or the black, yeah, dyslexic or whatever. did you have a lot of volume?
Yeah, so I think we did 12 events. We did a lot of experimentation in our business model and ended up with something that I think was the most reasonable or interesting opportunity, which was actually taking this as a learning and development experience and selling it to big groups of marketers like a marketing agency as a quick sort of gauntlet, 8-hour gauntlet to put your marketers through. Yeah. and so we actually did sell a couple of those to marketing agencies.
So sounds like you're starting to become maybe profitable or at least not die.
From
a business perspective.
True. I will say, so in the meantime, I had applied for food stamps. And I was getting welfare. So I was definitely going by the skin of my teeth at that point.
Could you afford ramen on welfare?
I found this grocery store that had 8 packs of hot dogs for like $5, something like that.
It's less than a dollar a dog.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was, it might have even been 5 packs for
$5. Oh yeah.
It was something like super crazy cheap. And so I just like, I went on an all hot dog diet for a little while.
No vegetables?
No, I got a big ass sinus infection after.
From your entire hot dog diet?
Yes.
I love it.
I do not recommend the hot dog only diet.
Well, hot dogs plus maybe some sauerkraut could work. Could work.
Could work, that's your vegetable.
There's some potassium in the sauerkraut.
Yeah, that's right. And it's got some of those healthy bacteria.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I was definitely very unhealthy, and.
But still, I think you're getting a lot of super valuable feedback and experience. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was my first exposure to enterprise sales.
Yeah.
Trying to sell something to a company, which becomes very relevant in the next phase of the story, which is where I am now.
And what's the so let's get to today. So here you are on food stamps, doing a kind of marketing conference experimental, you know, thing.
Sure.
And how did you, you know, go from a crawl to a walk?
So in that company strategy hack, I had had a lot of inspiration from something called Startup Weekend.
Yes.
Which people might be familiar with.
Very. Now, the one by Techstars or just the original?
The original.
Yeah, yeah.
This was still in 2013.
Yeah, and they're still going.
2013, 2014. Yep, that's right. So coincidentally, I took a conscious step back from working on strategy hack because I felt like we'd kind of exercised all of our opportunity on different business models and didn't really find anything that stuck. And I took a small consulting gig here and there, and in doing so, went back to doing a lot of networking events and ended up finding one of the co-founders of Startup Weekend.
Okay.
At a networking event.
And what's their name?
Frank.
Okay.
Or Franck. He's French. It turned out he had been trying to execute something I think they were calling Startup Weekend Corporate.
Ah.
So it was like a weekend event where you get all these corporate folks together with their ideas, not business ideas necessarily, but it could be sort of internal ideas of ways to improve their own large corporation. And he'd been frustrated in some of that endeavor, and so we started talking a lot about what I'd learned from Strategy Hack and enterprise sales and what he'd learned from doing Startup Weekend Corporate enterprise sales. And we said, you know what, like, we should really have a coffee and keep talking about this. And then we had coffee, and then it was like, you know, this is like a few days later, had coffee, and it's like, well, you know, it's about lunchtime, let's go get some lunch. And so we were effectively co-founder dating. And ended up deciding to start a company together.
So what was this company? I'm on the tip of my toes. So
that was 4 years ago. That's the same company that I'm running now. It's called ReCorp. And we are effectively trying to displace management consulting. It's a grandiose statement, but what it means in reality is that all of our consultants are ex-entrepreneurs, people who've built and sold companies in the past, who are actively coming into large corporations, large projects inside corporations, and bringing their startup expertise into that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the last 4 years, we've worked with tons of major brands in some pretty high level engagements. You can check out our website if you want to see some of the companies that we've worked with.
I think there's Uber, I think there's E-Trade?
Yep. I will confirm those.
There's a few more that I could dig up deep in the archives, but yeah.
Yeah, there's some that it's. I want to be careful not to mention necessarily what we did for each company.
Of course.
But we've done we've done a lot of e-commerce fraud prevention projects. We've done a lot of new product development projects, some of which have turned into actual products, some of which, despite our best efforts, have been shelved. Had a lot of successes and failures through that business. Thankfully, many more successes than failures in this case.
I just want to show the Zen Garden. It's so cool.
We can even,
let's walk through it.
Let's do it. We'll get some Zen on us. I've ended up in this really interesting space of kind of going back to thinking a lot about what frustrated me in that engineering internship that I did in 2004, thinking about all the ways in which there are economic and managerial inefficiencies in the way that corporations are structured now, and starting to think at a very high level about strategy and execution of how those things could change.
Now, one curveball, and the first of many, how does Voyager fit into all of this?
Good question. Voyager was one of our consulting projects.
Yeah.
So as ReCorp, we worked with someone, a funder who is very excited about the idea of starting an incubator for travel companies. And we said to them, there are tons of incubators in the world, incubator accelerators, all these other places that a startup could go if they want some kind of help and funding. You're kind of too late. This is 2016. Our opinion was you're too late to really set up something that's going to attract the best of the best, because they're going to go to Y Combinator or Techstars. And so we said instead, we think you'd be well served. If you do want to make some investments into the travel startup sector, you'd be well served to actually create a community of travel startups and provide resources that a lot of, you know, thousands of startups could take advantage of these resources that you're aggregating rather than getting, say, maybe picking 10 companies twice a year. So that was the fundamental pitch. They liked it. And so we spent 4 months putting the whole thing together, recruiting the team, including John Mattson, who's done an amazing job in the last 3 years of turning that vision into a very robust reality.
And I know John.
There you go. John, coincidentally, also helps us run the Startup Grind events that I've been running for the last 7 years.
Did you start Startup Grind?
I did not start Startup Grind.
Yeah. No. What's the backstory on that?
So Startup Grind is an event series that is organized around a fireside chat idea. So it's an interviewer and an interviewee, and the interviewee is meant to always be someone who's very successful in the startup realm. Mostly it's operators, people who've actually founded very successful companies. Sometimes it's investors. But I've been running the New York City chapter for the last 7 years. There were a few events that predated me, but I've done, I think, roughly 70 out of the total 80 events that have been done in New York City.
So you've held the torch for a significant amount of time.
When I started, Startup Grind had about 30 chapters, 30, and it now has about 800 chapters around the world.
And as an organization, you can go and see the individual events, and you know, what else is there about the organization that people should know about? Like, I'm genuinely curious, like, how can one take advantage of it?
Great question. I think, first of all, whether you are in the city where you live or you're traveling, you can almost always find a Startup Grind chapter. So with more than 10 chapters in Nigeria, for example. And so pretty much you can almost guarantee anywhere that you go, you can find the local startup community in that city.
Yes.
Startup Grind is meant to be a rallying point for the tech community in whatever city.
And that's where I met you.
And that's where we met each other.
In the New York chapter.
Yep.
And so when I go travel, you know, and I've done one episode, and I'm totally open to doing Startup Hunter around the globe.
Yeah.
I'll be sure to check into the Startup Grinds wherever, whether it's in Lagos or hopefully Shanghai.
Yeah, absolutely. So Startup Grind is actually absolutely exploding in China.
Yeah.
There's, I think it's Shanghai is doing like something insane, like 40 events a year. It's like almost an event every week.
Yes.
And they're getting hundreds and hundreds of people. And what's interesting, I think, over the last 10 years is there's been this whole evolution of the entrepreneur toolkit. And I'm using that phrase generally, meaning whether you're talking about the software coding languages that you're using, whether you're talking about the availability of funding, whether you're talking about the ability to find a co-founder and someone that you can create a business with. There's all of these resources and opportunities and methodologies that, like the entrepreneur operating system, that have been developed because there's been this huge explosion of startup thinking and ethos all around the world. It's something that corporations are struggling to figure out, struggling to take advantage of a lot of these ideas and theories that have evolved only in the last decade.
So let me do two things, ask you a question and switch my arm. So let's maybe play a game.
Great.
If we could sort of describe, you said startup thinking, which I think is such an interesting phrase.
Sure.
If you could take a crack at describing startup thinking in one sentence. What is startup thinking?
Rapid testing and iteration. If you want to try to distill all of these ideas into one core thought, it's the idea that rather than spending 6 months on strategy and then 6 weeks on execution, you should be spending 6 weeks thinking about what you want to do and then the next 6 months testing it.
Uh-huh.
And you can because of the internet, because of connectivity, because of all these other things, you can, especially when it comes to consumer products, you can very, very quickly get feedback on whether the thing that you want to build or the prototype that you've already built is viable or not.
Mm.
And so when we're talking about the last, let's say 20 years, and you're talking about technology, you go from an idea of waterfall to an idea of agile, and that's a huge idea shift and cultural, huge idea shift and cultural shift. Actually, I think Microsoft is a really interesting example of a company that was deeply, deeply embedded in this waterfall way of thinking, which is you have Windows 95, you spend the next 5 years building the next operating system. You spend 2 years designing it, you spend a year prototyping it, you spend a year putting it in the hands of some consumers to see how they react to it. Microsoft, there's a lot more detail to this, but they really started to fall behind because they were not understanding their consumer as much as a company like Apple, who at the same time that Microsoft was struggling, you know, Apple created the iPhone.
Now, yeah, and when you say Apple, it has to be Apple under Steve Jobs, because Apple post Steve Jobs is not the same. And I totally sold my shares of Apple very close to the time that he passed away. And I think, you know, even to this day, that they have not proven that, like, Tim Cook just doesn't seem to be a true visionary. He's a great caretaker.
Yeah.
And I think, and I said, this has been on the record forever, but I'm just gonna cut that thought off right there and continue it. Whereas Satya Nadella at Microsoft, I'm a little bit more behind him. Right. You know, he's more of a visionary. And to even, if you'll come with me, because we're practically on a block owned by Google, I like the way that Sundar Pichai, you know, he seems to be a little bit more of a visionary, you know, of having that real startup CEO kind of mentality, yet still being able to do it at a big company.
Yeah, no, so I think you're bringing up the concept of styles of leadership. There's a visionary leader, Tim Cook is a little bit more of a practical leader.
Yes.
In the sense, you know, he was essentially the CFO when Steve Jobs was the leader of Apple, right? There's a role and a leadership style that goes along with each of these different types of personalities. Steve Jobs may have been a visionary leadership at the cost of sanity and personal lives of a lot of the people that worked for him.
Yeah, right. So there may be a hidden cost to the genius.
Yeah. Yeah, I struggle with the word genius to begin with.
Uh-huh.
I think Apple benefited and Steve Jobs benefited from sort of seeing him as the figurehead and holding him up as the figurehead. Apple as a corporation benefited from that instead of viewing Apple as an ensemble. If you think about marketing a movie, for example, you might say this is a Brad Pitt movie, or you might say this is a movie with an all-star cast, ensemble cast. And Apple was very much the like movie star version of a corporation.
Hey, you have Johnny Ives who just left.
Yeah, but nobody knew Johnny Ives' name when Steve Jobs was the CEO.
Mm.
You know, that's Johnny Ives has come to prominence in large part as Tim Cook has taken over Apple.
Yeah.
Because they're presenting Apple differently than when it was under Steve Jobs, though it might function in very the same way. In very much the same way.
When I read the Walter Isaacson book on Steve Jobs, Johnny Ives was, you know, really played a prominent role in that. And then
absolutely.
I think that's literally how I knew.
Yeah. But there are many other people at Apple that played a very, very prominent role in creating things like Apple Music, iTunes, in creating other things that we think is of as extremely iconic to Apple. But the company as a whole sort of moved its marketing and communication strategy toward Steve Jobs is this iconoclastic, visionary, godlike leader. That is part of their marketing campaign. And you know, him on stage with the jeans and the black turtleneck is all part of the shtick of this guy's different. This is like the next version of hippie. He's mixing all of these different genres. The modern equivalent would be Elon Musk, right? Who's very much using his persona. But yeah, Elon Musk the person versus Elon Musk the persona. And a lot of, you know, when you see him getting into a Twitter battle with the SEC, that's the persona taking over, making sure that he's in the media, making sure that he's taking a lot of coverage and attention, because that's part of the whole shtick. In the same way that Steve Jobs was creating this iconoclastic persona that had a lot of gravity to it.
So how do we get derailed onto corporate CEOs? And
I was talking about Microsoft as an example of losing their way, sort of by continuing to go down this waterfall product
Windows
development.
95.
Yeah, exactly. So when you think about the startup mentality, the startup ethos, you think about a 2-week release cycle, right? Whereas Windows was coming out every few years, a lot of the products like mobile apps that we use now are coming out every 2 weeks.
Yes.
And they're being iterated and adapted. And Tumblr, also in the news recently because it was acquired for a very low number after being sold to Yahoo a few years ago for $1 billion.
I've never been a fan of Tumblr.
Well, yeah. So regardless of whether you're a fan or not, they had a very interesting product.
Oh, absolutely.
They had a very interesting product rollout strategy, which was, and David Karp, people should check out if they haven't. He's a very interesting guy. They would, instead of making a big press announcement, hey, Tumblr now has this new feature, they would do the work to build the feature. They would roll it out to, let's say, 10% of the user base, not tell anybody, and just see if people clicked on it or not. That is totally antithetical to the Microsoft waterfall development style, right? We're gonna build this thing, we're gonna roll it out, we're just gonna see if people engage with it or not, and if people don't, we don't need to bother with a press release because it's just gonna make us look bad.
Uh-huh.
If people do engage with it, then we can roll it out to 25% of the user base. And that if people are really resonating with that, then we can roll it out to everybody and make a big press release about it.
And these are like the seriously wonderful things. Like a startup doesn't even have the luxury of doing a press release, you know? Like
sure,
when
true.
You're slightly...
But a press release is almost irrelevant now.
Yeah.
Because you can, what you probably really want to do is find someone who has a big influential following and get them to say something about
it. Like not me yet.
getting there. That's, we've seen a lot of companies in the last 5, 6, 7 years tied to celebrity, right? So you see, I think it's called The Honest Company with Jessica Alba.
Of course. You have
all of these different like major consumer brands, Goop with Gwyneth Paltrow. That's a big reason that they're tied to those big personalities, is because that is sort of an immediate following, an immediate consumer base.
Lady Gaga just did a makeup brand.
Sure, yeah, I mean, even before the last 5 to 7 years,
yeah.
A lot of celebrities, Michael Jordan famously with the Air Jordans, right? But what we've seen is that's now translated into all of these digital brands and things where you can spin up a clothing, fast fashion brand in like 2 months.
I'm so glad I can't remember the actor. I saw the worst like cheesy, it was like video poker, just so bad. It was, and it was in the last week, and there was a major celebrity behind it. It was so cheesy. I'm like, oh no.
There was.
People are, I'm sure, gonna think that like SMS stickers are like way in the past, but like Kim Kardashian had this sticker pack that you could buy. I think it was like $1.99 or something like that. And they sold like hundreds of millions or $1 billion.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be
just
surprised.
just on sticker packs. I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting to reflect on persona and celebrity in 2019, because it is, it's more, I think it's more powerful and can reach more people than ever before.
And yet, I had somebody on the show recently who literally tried to reverse engineer the whole celebrity thing.
Yeah.
And he got 30 influencers on board, like combined view, millions of views, and he did it for 6 months. It was sort of like a VJ platform, and he failed at that.
Okay.
And now he runs an insurance company, which is quite a hot startup. And so it's interesting how celebrity, you know, leveraging celebrity isn't always a slam dunk.
No, you need a product market fit. You need something people are actually going to buy. And that's, I was thinking about another example with Akon, the rapper.
Of course.
Who created Akoin.
In Senegal or here?
Globally, yeah. I mean, it's cryptocurrency. And the didn't exactly take off the way that other cryptocurrencies did.
It might
still be a going concern, I don't know.
We haven't even spoken about your whole crypto world. Like, can I propose this to you? Can we talk crypto for 2 blocks? Sure. And then I'll ask my final question to you.
Okay, sounds good.
So let's talk crypto, Peter.
You ask me a question, I'll answer.
Like, I am just trying to understand crypto. help. Okay. Like, I know, I can name some names, but just help us all, like, give us sort of, you know, temperature reading.
Prognostication?
Yeah, so just like in the last week or month, and where do you think it's all going? And
sure. I mean, it breaks down now into a lot of territory, a lot of different aspects. As far as Bitcoin, or the idea that one of these currencies would be used as an actual means of trade, an actual currency, seems very unlikely because the values continue to be so all over the place, which is great if you're a speculative investor. People who deploy exactly the right strategy can make a huge amount of money off of all this volatility. That said, the excitement and hype and the amount of funding available around this ecosystem has started to develop much more interesting concepts that go way beyond currency. The first one, which has been around for quite a long time in startup years, is Ethereum.
Yes.
Which has a currency component called Ether, but it also has a smart contract component and a lot of other ways that it can be deployed, and other people have actually built things on top of it.
Well, Ethereum to me is really one. You know, you got, I've saw the original founder of Ethereum. Never met Joseph Lubin, but he's already got guys, you know, that are at the World Bank level, you know, attending his conferences.
Oh, definitely. So I think, first of all, I believe there are 8 co-founders of Ethereum.
Ooh.
Yeah. Vitalik Buterin is the most prominent, probably because he is the wunderkind, or whatever you want to call it, the sort of spiritual leader. Joseph Lubin, I think, is very prominent in the news because he was, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I believe he put more money into the system at the beginning than anyone else did. And so as the valuation increased, he benefited quite a bit. And he was listed at some point as one of cryptocurrencies billionaires. And prices have come back down a lot since then, so who knows where exactly he's at. But he also founded Consensus, which is a kind of product lab and consulting company, which then was another reason for his name to become a persona and to become much more prominent in order to promote that company.
I mean, I just can't figure out, you know, you have Facebook's, well, I can figure it out. You have Facebook's Libra, you know, is it a trend? I think there are some real, you know.
Trends are self-fulfilling, right? So calling something a trend isn't necessarily, I mean, TV is a trend,
you know?
There was a time when TV was a fad, and if you were one of the few families in the neighborhood that had a TV, it was a novelty, and other people would come over just to stare at it.
Yeah.
But then it started to get more content. It was actually in part supported by the US government by actually making this bandwidth available for public broadcasting.
Yeah.
Then you had color TVs, which was like the next trend. It's like everyone had the black and white TV, but you could get the color TV.
Then you had cable.
Yeah. But I mean, so the counterpoint to that is something like 3D printing. Everyone was insanely excited about 3D printing 8 years ago. You had a few startups with huge valuations at the time. We were saying everyone's gonna have a 3D printer on their table at home because why wouldn't you? You know, fast forward even 2 years later, it's kind of like, well, that's over. So when it comes to blockchain, blockchain is different from what a lot of people expect, or it's different from the way that people talk about it, because it's a little bit like saying, is cloud computing a trend? It's you're asking an infrastructure question. The blockchain technology, the idea of blockchain is something that you could deploy in a lot of different contexts. And so a very common example right now is tokenized assets, meaning you could, in theory, you could have a currency that's built on blockchain. You could also have a blockchain that allows you to store and monitor ownership of a physical asset, like a building,
yep.
Like one of these buildings.
Yep. Somebody on the show has been in the real estate blockchain space.
You could do the same thing for a company, right? So a company is something that you can own shares in. And so in theory, you could digitally track ownership of a non-physical asset like a company through a blockchain.
I think we can go forever on this. So let's pause that for the time being and get to the most important question, I think, of the show.
Okay, great.
So, Peter,
yes,
how do you think you have grown as an entrepreneur? In what ways?
I think that I've sort of changed and morphed how I think about what I'm doing and sometimes what I'm practically doing on like a 6 month cycle for the last 10 years. So it's not a question of whether I've grown, it's maybe what's stayed the same. I think for me, I've come to learn and feel that values and personal motivation are really at the core of entrepreneurship and trying to launch something new, at least for me. And having kind of a North Star in terms of when you as a person or you as a business are making business decisions, what rubric, what lens are you looking at those decisions through? And having a set of values, whatever they happen to be, where you can say, we'll match this decision against those values. I think that's both something that I've increasingly learned and something that's been core to me the whole time, because I realize how important, how deeply those values are held.
Yeah.
And so for me, I fundamentally believe that even the global corporation is inefficiently managed, and that there's a much better and more effective way to do that. And that's that is a deeply held belief that comes out of all of the experiences that I've laid out for you. But it's also a guiding principle for what we do with ReCorp now, in saying it can be better, it should be better, we have people to make it better, so let's make it better.
You heard it. Let's make it better.